This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Paul Muldoon, the poetry editor of the magazine, and it's a delight to have you with us today. Now, on this program, as you probably know, we invite a poet to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive. We read it, we talk about it, then we ask the poet to read one of her own poems that's been published in the magazine. And I'm thrilled to say that with me today is Eileen Miles, who, among many distinctions, has been the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship in nonfiction, and she's the author of 19 books of poetry. Welcome, Eileen Miles.
Hi, Paul.
So the poem that we're looking at today, the poem that you've chosen, is White Boat, Blue Boat by James Schuyler. Presumably, James Schuyler was someone you knew?
He was a good friend. I worked for him for a period of time, and after that, we just became close and had been a hero before any of that. So,
now, when you say you worked for him, were you an assistant? Or mm-hmm.
Yeah, he lived in the Chelsea Hotel, and he had just moved in there, and his army of friends hired me to, you know, do everything for him and anything, and I did.
Now, presumably that was the heyday of the Chelsea Hotel. I'm sure that the Chelsea Hotel is still in that scintillating place, but it was perhaps more scintillating.
The heyday was long, but I think this is at the far end of 79. So it was still pretty cool. There was still lots of bands. It was post Sid and Nancy, but there were still plenty of weird, cool people there.
You know, I'm sure listeners would love to know a little more about what the poetry scene in New York was like. It's not so long ago, but seems like a different era.
Well, I think lots of us lived in the same neighborhood, which was the East Village. I mean, I moved to New York a few years before, but moved to the East Village both for the rents and for the company. And what that largely was at that time was poets and people in bands. And it was just starting to be a day of, you know, all-night Ukrainian restaurants. And they just, you know, the CBGB's was like very live and very new and, you know, word of mouth. And so there was and everybody had a lot of time because we lived so cheaply. And it was really amazing.
And we weren't on the internet.
We were present, and there were so many bookstores, and poets were making a living selling their books. People were finding books, and you know, people often didn't have phones. You would just buzz the buzzer.
Do you think of the world of poets as being a companionable one, or one in which people are acting perhaps as solo agents?
Oh, well, I mean, both, of course. I mean, I think we're all kind of a bunch of loners, mm-hmm. but a bunch of loners who need each other very much. I mean, the idea of a school of poets just has to do with the fact that people need to kind of cluster in a way to, you know, because when I came to New York, everybody told me what I should read and what I shouldn't read, and mostly they were men. And so I had to kind of ramble around and take a little something from here and a little something from there. But when I gravitated towards a group whose poetry made so much sense to me and had something to do with what I wanted to do, it was an exciting, I felt like I had found a home.
Now, would you align yourself with the New York School?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the aesthetic, one of many, but maybe the reigning aesthetic of St. Mark's Church, where I, you know, which really stood in as graduate school for me. I mean, they had free workshops that were funded by the NEA in that, at that time. You just walk in on Friday night with your beer and sit down, and Alice Notley or Ted Berenger would be there, and the other, you know, 10 or 12 young people in the East Village that wanted to be in the room with them.
So now, James Schuyler, or Jim Schuyler as he would have been known, was a prominent member of the New York School. What would you say in his work typifies that school, if I were to be kind of schoolmasterly here?
Vernacular. Schuyler's work is so vernacular. And it's very funny because it's very simple language, and it's much less, abstract than Ashbery's in a certain way. Though Ashbery's isn't really when you look close, but the overall feel. But Schuyler's, you know where you are. And so they look like very simple, sometimes even kind of childlike poems. But there'll always be a whoosh of common talk in a way. Like there's a poem of his that I love is called Six Something, you know? And it's just that blur of six what? 6 o'clock, 6:15, six, you know, June what? You know, it's just... And we do talk that way. And Schuyler was very quick to pick up. I mean, he called his own poetry point and snap, you know. And I think it is that on every level, not just visual, but a kind of organizing way of talking slang.
So these poets, Frank O'Hara, I think of very much in this vein also, of course, were taking Wordsworth's notion of poetry having to do with the language of the common man, the mm-hmm. language of everyday speech. They were taking that to the nth degree, really.
Sure. But while being very educated, very middle class, upper middle. These we're talking about, I mean, not Schuyler, but, you know, Ashbery and Harrow, guys who went to Harvard, you know, people who went to prep school. I mean, we're not, you know, but in love with the street, you know, rather than necessarily being men of the street, you know, having the ear of the street, you know. But Stein, too, I think that was the belief that the language, as we know, changes there.
You know, I was reading a little bit about James Schuyler, and in anticipation of our conversation, just reminding myself, and I came across a really what I think is an interesting quote from Barbara Guest, who, of course, was one of the other main women involved with the New York School. Mm-hmm. And she refers to him, I see here, as an intimist. Mm-hmm. An intimist. She says, for me, Jimmy is the Vayar office, mm-hmm. presumably the French painter who specialized in interiors. He withholds his secret, the secret thing, until the moment appears to reveal it. We wait and wait for the name of a flower while we praise the careful cultivation. We wait for someone to speak, and it is Jimmy in an aside.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Well, I think the word intimist is absolutely perfect for him. It's close and it's touchable, and it has just this quality of sweetness that I think we do associate with intimacy, you know, dangerous sweetness even.
Right. Can we hear you read this poem, any chance? It's White Boat, Blue Boat, which appeared in the November 27th, 1989
mm-hmm.
issue of the magazine. So here's Eileen Miles reading White Boat, Blue Boat by James Schuyler.
White boat, blue boat. Two boats parked and posing in the sun-struck winter landscape, rough grass, bare with green washes, against self-colored bark, live twigs end in red buds. You can't see it, the red, and when you do, you can't not see it, against a scaling trunk that, higher than three men on each other's shoulders, becomes more trunks. Beyond marsh grass and reeds scratched swiftly in, a woman goes by, her dog too, in short lopes, a mutt. The day can't get brighter, clearer, but it brightens, brightens so much and so much more under infinite cloudlessness and icy spaces and endless mystery.
It really is as if one is having a painting described to one. That's really its method, I suppose, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And an animated one, too, or a painting that suddenly became a film, because it always does one thing, and then it just starts opening from there, you know, and so there's a progression all the time that is almost is the intimacy. Is, that's the shock effect, that you see something beautiful and your own awe should hold it still, but in fact it's alive.
Well, part of the effect, of course, is that it's as if we're discovering in real time what is what, mm-hmm. What the poet, what the speaker of the poem is discovering. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit here, a little bit there, and it sort of all adds up. Wonderful technique. I mean, that description, for example, of the scaling trunk that higher than three men on each other's shoulders uh-huh. becomes more trunks. And the relationship between the trunk of the human body and the trunk of the tree, you know, which could easily be a bit, let's say, overstated, mm-hmm. is really done quite delicately.
Right, right. And it winds up being even a little bit sexy. You don't have to think about it too much, but it's there, too, the engagement with a man's body, with a man's trunk.
I love this use of the word scaling. I mean, mm-hmm. it's an indicator, yet again, just of how terrifically precise Schuyler is, scaling both in the sense of the scale, I suppose, of the tree, in the sense of the rough surface of the tree, the scale in the fish scale sense, and then the scale in the ladder sense.
And he brings the men in with that verb before they're even there, because a scaling trunk is about the climbing, you know, and the going up. And you know, the tree ain't doing that. The human body is, or the human gaze is. So it's sort of in advance of the human presence, it's there.
And in fact, it also goes in the direction of scale and the notion of perspective, you know, the size of one thing in relation to another, the kind mm-hmm. of idea that Elizabeth Bishop was terrifically interested in. Masterful.
Mm-hmm. And it's also it's just a statement of the fact that a view is always a thing of great depth, you know, that it's not the foreground or the background, it's the mini grounds. You know, and that's what he reveals to us in his kind of like moving commodity.
Many of these New York School poets were deeply, deeply engaged in the visual arts. Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe too, in a profound sense, all poets are mm-hmm. Image makers.
And I think, for one thing, because it relieves you of the culture of us, i.e. poetry, and the culture of another. And you get to have conversations about their moves and think about things that we do in sort of an abstract way. You know, you replace language with stuff, and then you watch how stuff moves, and then we translate back. So I think there's kind of an other for us in the art world.
You know, I've always been a bit confused, I think, as to, you know, what exactly were the roots of this particular school. We often hear Wallace Stevens mentioned, particularly vis-a-vis John Ashbery, for example. But you mentioned Gertrude Stein there a moment. Mm-hmm. She's obviously an influence. What about William Carlos Williams? He seems to lie somewhere not too far behind a poem like this?
I mean, unavoidable. I mean, I think he's just some of the bones. I mean, I think him and Stevens are just like American poetry. I mean, there it is. There's the two tendencies in the big way in the
right.
20th century. But I think Apollinaire, absolutely. I think Pasternak, you know. I think Mayakovsky. So I think, in a way, all of modernism is something that they were kind of grabbing from and excited about. And then I think each one had their own perversities. I mean, when John Ashbery told us he was reading John Clare, we all started reading John Clare. And I think so there's lots of tiny discoveries, you know.
That was Eileen Miles reading White Boat, Blue Boat by James Schuyler.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real because your fashion purchase will be backed by authenticity guarantee. Whether it's an it bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay authenticity guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Then, in the August 24th, 2016 issue of The New Yorker, Eileen Miles, we were delighted to publish your poem, Dissolution, and which you're going to read for us now. Actually, why don't you read it for us first, and then we can talk about it, if we may. Mm-hmm. Dissolution.
Great. Dissolution. Sometimes I forget what country I'm in. I could write poems in bed. I think have some Americans look at your awful movie to tell you when you're wrong and just racist. I get this bug bite that could be anything. Got no new information to send across. I'm willing to embrace new sort of crayon-y tone, scribbled version of empty so it's kind of full. A kid could draw this world it had been lived in so long. You forgot to call your family and now you're ready to write an explicit Bible of love. The ripple of experience is the only beauty here. My coloring book, Why Not, is so like a movie. And I just hand you this damp coloring book. I say, there. That's my model. Not the kind of laminate shit you can bring in the tub. I'm not making some picture book of bourgeois life. A damp coloring book is naturally orange. You left it outside. Now you want to save it? It's still good, and that's your secret. How did a mosquito get under these sheets, knocking against my calf? They stop when I stop thinking about them. The book that was my very private thing is gone.
Thank you so much. Dissolution. Now, the word dissolution, of course, goes in a couple of directions again, but that's what words do. Dissolution in the sense of what we used to refer to as I hesitate from saying this, but loose living, at least hanging out and, you know, dissolution, drinking, whatever, smoking, what all those things we used to do back in the day. And also, of course, just in its literal sense, I suppose, of things dissolving, of things being knots being unpicked, problems being solved. What else?
I mean, sure. I think the thinginess of the poem can be dissolute, too. You know, I mean, I think people always expect poetry to be beautiful, you know, and I know since Baudelaire that's been challenged. But I think to keep writing poems, we challenge it again and again. And so I think I was thinking both from the condition of the self who was writing the poem and thinking this is a dissolute moment and therefore the poem would be dissolute and it would be kind of a destroyed object. And then to maybe relish that position, to be writing about something that's sort of wrecked and then to kind of pull each little piece of it out. And I think it's always an act of analysis among the many things that a poem is, you know, to look at all the parts of the thing that you're sitting in and to say what's beautiful, what's messed up, what's funny, what's great, and link it to all the other things that have been perhaps – I was in an artist colony when I wrote this, and so you're always exposed to lots of other people's work. So it wasn't that somebody had shown some lousy racist movie, but I think it began a conversation in my head that hadn't stopped. Because I think that's part of the thing about being a poet too is you never say everything. I mean, I think you were saying that about Skylar early. It's never a complete thought. It's a partial thought. So there's always lots of other pieces floating around ready to be applied or popped into some poem.
Well, it's a little bit like the vernacular that we were talking about earlier on. It's as if we're looking somehow at an unmade bed, something that's overheard, something that's sighted through a window, rather than some beautiful ornament that's been presented with, you know, hospital corners or whatever the term is. It's, or, you know, the bed that we meet when we come into a hotel room.
Right.
It's the opposite of that.
Right. Well, it's like when we have our picture taken, you know, like, and we're living in such an age where it's happening all the time and they catch a weird one and then you think, I can do better than that. And then you kind of form your face into a better pose. And so there's a lot of that going on too. Like, just as this whole mess is strewn, suddenly one, you know, says the ripple of experience is the only beauty here. You know, like a need to make a speech is always part of this kind of puddle.
You interestingly used a phrase of Skylar earlier on about his, were they snapshots or?
A point and snap.
Point and snap, which was a term that used to be used in the olden days when many of us had cameras.
Right.
You pointed and snapped. And I really, what I'm coming around to asking you about is if you feel that in a way this method that was so beloved of and inextricably bound up with the New York School hasn't in a way actually become more part of the back of our minds or the front of our minds indeed in a world where there is so much that's impromptu and mm-hmm. unmade and where everything has been snapped.
Right, right. No, I think exactly. I think we're living in that time. I mean, I think the kind of what was regarded as sort of a New York School way of framing things is kind of the virtual experience we're all having all the time. If you look at Twitter, so many lines just sound like a little pronouncement from one of these guys' poems or the poems that they inspired, you know, in the following generations. I mean, advertising sounds like a New York School poem. But, you know, but then the New York School poem was advertising. O'Hara himself once made a movie called The Last Clean Shirt, and in it he's watching a couple ride around in a T-Bird through New York someplace in the 60s, and then he wrote the subtitles. And suddenly you get this sense of this yippie, like what it was like to be in America after World War II when everybody thought everything was great and we won and people hadn't started getting assassinated yet. And there was just this, people still believe in progress. So that fullness of existence was all over their poems, you know, and you know, it's different now, but we can still hit the mark with a high, excited line.
I'm fascinated by what you say here. I mean, it's as if there was a moment for those of us of a certain age, I suppose, sometime in the maybe mid 1960s, I don't mm-hmm. know where one would put it, when there was a sense that actually things could get better. Where there was some sense of hope,
mm-hmm.
we don't seem to have it anymore.
Not as an overall surge that everybody feels like they're living in. That's not the shape of the times. I mean, I think that we're, you know, endlessly getting pieces of mail that tell us, well, what about the hummingbirds? You know, what about the bees? And what about this, you know, this canyon? I mean, there's so much, we're so aware of loss. So it's like, how does one tweet in a way, you know, like how does one kind of sustain a joyous feeling? And I think you don't. I think you just take it when you see it.
Yeah, let me ask you, this is a rather large question, but how would you say the poet, you yourself and other poets who are functioning now in 2016 as it happens, how are we to deal with making sense of the world at the moment? How are we going to do this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the word you applied to Schuyler, intimist, is there for all of us. I mean, I think the hardest thing about the world we're living in right now is the question of whether I am inside of it. You know, you're always being torn out by your phone, by your messages, by your pace. I mean, everybody knows that it was slower in other times, that 10 years ago it was slower, and 10 years before that. When I think about what the 70s felt like. So I think that I have to find a thing that everybody needs to find, and I think one of the ways I find it is through poems. One of the times that I can control and manage is the time within my poem. It's a very small space, but I think part of what people get when they read a poem is not necessarily a slow experience, but a considered one in a certain way. A person is trying to make sense of their inside and their outside. So the negotiation is going on, you know, and it's not a Zen talk, it's a poem.
I suppose a poem by necessity is a slowing down of things, though, of course, there is an argument for speeding up to be in sync mm-hmm. with the speed of the moment.
Well, I think we make jokes in our poems all the time. For some reason, I was reading a long piece about the iPhone 7, and I just thought about dropping that in a poem, you know. And things like that make you know that the reader will know that the slow person they're reading is moving in their fast world. You know, like Schuyler's poems, the perspectives are multiple. And so are the speeds that we're all having to figure out how to live in a fast, slow time. And each different mix is signature, and that's what we're offering.
One of the dangers of being up to the moment and mentioning the iPhone 7 is, of course, that probably in 2 years' time, I mean, this is a bit of an overstatement, but it's conceivable that no one will know what an iPhone 7 is, in much the same way as we don't know what an Underwood is. Are you ever concerned about that in your own poems, about somehow being on off the moment is going to, in a strange way, date the poem down the road? Or is that even an issue?
No, because I think that's the exciting, that's part of the exciting time codes. You know, I mean, like mentioning John Clare. I mean, the thing people love about John Clare is that his poems are the first ones with no trespassing signs. So if I talk about gentrification or iPhone 7s, it's like authenticating the poem in a way. It's putting a timestamp on it that doesn't date it. It just, it kind of shows that it was new.
I think that's right. I think that's, we have to believe that on balance, that, you know, if we know the context in which Shakespeare wrote Macbeth, for example, you know, with James very concerned about witches, with plague in the air and all the rest of it, it does actually help us to understand the text.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, it's been fascinating talking to you.
Likewise.
We could talk all day, but I think we have to come to an end. Thank you very much indeed, Eileen Miles, for being with us today. White Boat, Blue Boat by James Schuyler, as well as Eileen Miles, your own poem, Dissolution, may be found on newyorker.com. Eileen Miles' latest book of poems is I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems. And then James Schuyler's final collection, alas, was his selected poems. I'm Paul Muldoon, poetry editor of The New Yorker. Until next time, goodbye.
You can hear more poetry read by the authors on newyorker.com and in the digital edition for tablets and smartphones, available at no extra charge in the App Store and on Google Play. The theme music is The Pitnacree Ferryman, from the album The Highlander's Farewell by Alistair Fraser and Natalie Haas from Colburnie Records.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.